born in Sydney in 1928, just on the eve of the big crash, the Depression. And we lived in Vaucluse, and I went to Sydney Boys High School and had quite a privileged upbringing, although my father lost his business as a result of the economic conditions.
And, what was his business?
He had a manufacturing business, and we went from having a Rolls-Royce to my father cleaning other people's cars.
Wow.
And
that's an extraordinary...
Well, it was a terrible time, really. I can still hear the unemployed men who'd come around selling clothes props, which in those days you had for your drying clothes line.
Okay,
you had a wooden stick with a fork, which they'd sell that, and people would come around selling rabbits.
So tell me,
unemployed, and I mean, there's terrible unemployment and so on.
So your father's business. So your father went from very wealthy, or
wealthy, but wealthy enough to buy a house in Vaucluse.
Yes,
wasn't quite what it is today then.
But a Rolls Royce.
Yes.
So do you how old were you? Like, what do you remember of growing up in terms of the wealth change?
A very happy childhood, because my mother and father were very happily married, and we weren't aware of the sort of international implications of the economic crash, but we never had much. And
did it affect your dad? Like, do you remember?
It did.
What do you remember of that?
Well, it did, and I think it affected him emotionally and psychologically, because he was a self-made man. He'd fought in the Boer War and had been wounded. I think it did a lot, not only for my father, but for that whole generation of losing confidence and self-worth. And
totally. Especially when so much of men's self-worth was about fighting in wars.
And it was.
Being heroic.
Yes.
And being the sole breadwinner most of the time.
It was. And it was a very difficult time.
Do you think because people sort of, we talk about how, past generations, men weren't encouraged to sort of show their emotions, certainly men weren't supposed to cry. And do you think, given that, your father wouldn't, not that it makes it any easier, but your father wouldn't have been the only person to be affected by extreme loss in terms of wealth, which becomes also self-worth, do you think that, men were uniting and talking about?
No. And they still don't.
And they, isn't that crazy? So many of them are going through the same thing.
It's so deeply ingrained. I recently, 2 years ago, lost my wife.
I'm so sorry about that.
And then I had surgery, a knee replacement, and my younger sister died.
Oh, gosh.
And without realizing it, I actually went into quite a period of depression.
Yeah.
I've never had any history of any sort of mental unease at all.
Yeah.
And finally, admitting it was the difficult thing.
Yes.
And saying to my daughters, I think I am in depression.
But that is...
And then I came through it, and it's been wonderful. But I think a lot of men, they feel that talking about their situation, even their health, you shouldn't do that. You're responsible for yourself. And
I think it's extraordinary that you, of your generation and age, actually recognize that what you were feeling was depression, because I think a lot of people put it down to, especially your age, I'm old,
that's just the way it is. You find all sorts of excuses.
That's exactly right. But did it make you realizing that you thought it was depression and that admitting it, because I've had depression myself, and
it's a great help.
But it is also very confronting. But
yes.
did it make you look back on, I guess, your father and that the Great Depression you lived on and realize what actually emotionally they were dealing with?
It did.
And they're still having to get on with things.
And you see, in those days, there wasn't the social support that there is now.
None.
There wasn't
none.
There wasn't any dole. There wasn't any.
No.
Basic wage. There's no health. There's no health insurance. Nothing like that. So you were really left to your own.
It makes sense of why alcoholism became such a problem.
Absolutely. Doesn't it? Yes.
Because you want to escape.
Absolutely. Our family was spared that curse.
Yeah.
But
not many were.
Quite true. No. Mm. Quite right.
Tell me about your teenage years. Growing up,
well,
in the 40s?
When I was 13 or 14, I had rheumatic fever. Now, it doesn't sound very much, and in those days they didn't know a lot about it, but an inevitable effect of rheumatic fever, it affected the valve in your heart. And the doctor, the specialist, said to my mother that you have to face the fact that Chris won't be able to live a normal life. Well, now that I'm on the edge of 90, I find that hard to believe. Maybe it was
the worst diagnosis.
But anyway.
But what did that mean for you? How did you feel? What is rheumatic fever?
I used to quote a saying from Cecil Rhodes, the great colonial developer in Africa, founded the Rhodes Scholarships.
Oh.
He said, "So much to do and so little time in which to do it." And that was as a young man on the edge of a career, that was what was in my mind.
Is it because you were...
Well, the doctor said I wouldn't...
Yeah, you don't have much time.
I wouldn't be able to lead a normal life.
That's extraordinary.
Which, of course, has proved quite untrue because I've worked in many countries
Your career is something that
I've had a valve replacement and triple bypass, and when I saw the heart specialist last month, he said, "Well, everything's fine. I don't want to see you for 12 months." So that was a good vote of confidence.
That's incredible. And you know what? I don't know whether you believe this, but I think sometimes things happen in our life for a purpose, and sometimes they manifest themselves as an illness. So what that your rheumatic fever did, it sounds like it revved you up and gave you, from a very early age, gratitude about time.
It did. It did indeed. And at the age of 18, 19, my family became very closely involved with an international movement called Moral Rearmament, which now has a much better name, rather ugly name that. It's now called Initiatives of Change, which works worldwide in the field of conflict resolution and bridging the gaps between races and nations languages and so on. And that led me later on to meeting Raj Mohan Gandhi, who's the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi.
Wow.
And he was working closely with us. And he decided to emulate his grandfather, who led the famous Salt March, which was a marking point in the fight for independence in India, where he marched to the sea and made salt, which was not legal, because there was a tax on salt.
Oh.
And this was his way of defying the British authorities.
Man needs salt as he needs air and water. This salt comes from the Indian Ocean. Let every Indian claim it as his right.
And so, once more, the man of non-violence has challenged the might of the British Empire.
So anyway, Raj Mohan Gandhi had the idea in the 1960s of leading a march across India, and the theme was a clean, strong and united India. And he asked me to join him. My wife and I joined him, and we We didn't actually march a lot.
How old were you and your wife then?
Well, then that was 1962.
Mm.
So I would have been 40, no, about 30, about 30, about 35.
Mm.
Mm. And so we took part in that. And at the end of it, we had a big meeting in New Delhi, chaired by his other grandfather, because this was the interesting thing. His father's father was Mahatma Gandhi. His mother's father was Rajagopalachari, who was the famous leader in India, and he became the first after Mountbatten, after the British left and the Indians had independence, he became the first Governor General, later President of India. So Rajmohan had a close touch with the people. And then he decided to launch a weekly news magazine and asked me to be the co-editor. So for the next 6 years, I was editing this in English language, of course.
Yeah. Based out of where? What city?
In Bombay.
Okay.
Mumbai.
Yep.
Now. And while I was there, my wife, who's Australian, our two daughters were born, and we loved our time in India. And I went back. I took my daughters back 10 years ago, or they say they took me back. But I took them back, and they loved their time in India and now want to take their children to
India. Oh, how extraordinary that these incredible...
It was a very interesting time in India. One of the interesting experiences while I was editor of this magazine was to...
What was the magazine called?
Himat. H-I-M-M-A-T.
And what is that?
And it means audacity, courage.
Oh,
in Hindi.
Fantastic.
Although it was an English language, because in India, English really is the only language that you can speak
to
all over
everybody.
The country.
Yeah.
Because if you're in the north, you speak Hindi. If you're in the south, you may speak Tamil.
Yeah.
But the Tamils don't speak Hindi, and the Hindi people don't speak Tamil, so they speak in English. And one of the tasks I had was interesting to go and visit the Dalai Lama, who had not long come out of China, and India had given him a sort of site for their government in exile in Dharamsala, up in the foothills of the Himalayas. And he was quite a young man then.
Yeah, what is a young Dalai Lama like?
And very interesting. And he was so...
You met him?
Oh, yes, yes. I interviewed him and had a long talk with him.
Oh, tell me about the interview. What do you remember of it?
Well,
What were you asking?
Well, he of course, had come out of China 3 or 4 years earlier.
Yeah.
Escaped, really. But he was he was very interested in my camera, and he was very technically...
Really?
Interested, yes.
Yeah, but he would, I presume, because he didn't really understand it, it wouldn't have been part of his world much, would it? No,
that's right. But, and also to give him a voice to the world, because he was not so well known then, having escaped.
And at that, so what age would he have been, do you think?
Well, he would have been, I think he's a bit younger than I, yes. Well, I'm 90 this year, so, and I think he's probably in his early 80s now. So.
Yeah. And so what do you remember of what was important to him to tell the world at his age then?
Well, I think what he wanted the world to understand is that Tibet should be independent.
Yeah, right.
Had been for a long time, but of course we forget that it also had been part of the Greater China before that. So... Mm. There were sort of political elements in it too.
Mm.
But he's been a remarkable person, and I've met him since several times.
How has he changed over the years, do you think?
I think he's mellowed a lot, and very wisely he's not got involved in political and ideological clash with Beijing.
Mm.
But they don't quite know how to handle it.
Friends, with utmost respect, I am interrupting this beautiful conversation now for a moment to thank my sponsors, Freedom Aged Care. So when I decided to do this podcast series, which really came from a genuine place of feeling like the one generation in our society being talked about the least was actually the one we needed to be listening to because these people have lived so much. So I decided to give an aged care company a go, and I chose one that I'd explored during my search to find somewhere for my dad to live. And I instantly loved what Freedom appeared to be about, which was celebrating the lives of their residents, but doing it with a really joyful touch. And I contacted a guy called Craig Flett, who's one of the family members involved with Freedom Aged Care, a guy I'd never met. And in an email, I poured my heart out on why I wanted to do this series. And to my great surprise, he instantly said he wanted to get on board. As he put it, Freedom's residents have together lived a million years of life, a fact that the company is really intensely proud of. So it's become a really beautiful, authentic union, and it's allowed me to get paid for what I love doing, and for them, hopefully it highlights their commitment to honouring the people who have led long, brave and interesting lives, and people who deserve not to be forgotten. So now, back to my wonderful guest. One of the interesting things I think that's been a theme in your life is change on a very, very big. Yeah, exactly. And it's really weird. I had this sense of before I was coming to meet you, I tell you what I want to know, and I don't want to jump over any of your history, but I just have this sense that you probably, someone from where you sit at your age, looking back on the wisdom around the word change when it comes to the world is something that I'm very, very interested to find out. In the last couple of weeks, I have been fascinated by the student reaction in America to the shooting in Florida, in the Florida school, and that extraordinary girl, young girl with a shaved head who was one of the students at that school, that speech she made and the way that's the ripple effect of the students saying, this, we've had enough. You know, there's a day they've set aside that they're going to sort of not come to school. But also the way I'm hearing that students from Australia and all over the world are kind of coming up almost in this incredible uprising from such young people on a subject that has horrified us all for years. No, it's not necessarily in our backyard as Australians, but horrified us for years that these people that we think that we know and they're our allies have constantly have murdered children every single year. And yet nothing can be done. It's painful to watch, even from us that are not affected.
And we've got to listen to the younger generation.
Because I feel like it's like, oh my God, could these young people change something that the adults have been saying for years and years and years is unchangeable?
Well, I'm a great believer in the fact that not only because I've got two daughters, but we've got to listen to the young people. Mm-hmm. And we've got to listen to the women.
And why do you say that?
Well, I think...
I mean, I'm all for it.
Well, it. I think the truth is that if women had been in positions of leadership in many countries, we wouldn't have had so much trouble in the world.
Mm. Well, in what way do you think female leaders would have changed things?
Because women, as I've come to learn from having a wife, a sister and two daughters.
Mm, a lot of women in your life.
they have a level of intuition which men clumsily often ignore.
Do you know, I think that's so beautiful that you say that. And I understand that from a level of when I told you I did breakfast FM style radio a few years back, and I really went into that. I was single and I went into it very, I think, you know, not consciously, but unconsciously judging these two different guys. They were very different guys, but I could see, I was sort of judging them. But what I realized was firstly, they had their own wisdom and so much for me to learn from each of them, as every human in your life regularly is. If they're there, they're there for a reason. But what I came to know and not fear as much is men, there isn't as much of that intuition with men. That doesn't mean that they don't have other brilliance. And actually, sometimes when I'm so busy with my head in the fairies and in my, you know, bag of intuition, sometimes I need a guy to just say it really plainly and to cut through all the stuff. So, but I know what you mean. But intuition in terms of a leadership, I mean, we haven't even seen that exist much.
Well, I think also women have a quality of discernment, and that's very hard to describe.
Yeah, but it's good a word, it's though, a, discernment,
well,
isn't
it? It's a sort of a hunch. You get a hunch about something.
Yes.
It's sort of an innate feeling you perhaps can't even define.
Mm.
But anyway, that's my... I mean, I don't think I've been ever upset as much as I was in the way Julie Gillard was treated.
Yeah.
And it's a great sadness.
What upset you about that? I mean, obviously I could see what was happening from my own point of view.
I still have in my mind, you know, the picture of her with the banners behind her, Julia. You know, that sort of...
Bullied.
Political... it is bullied. It's never really been repaired, I don't think.
I call the Prime Minister.
In a discussion about women being underrepresented in institutions of power in Australia, the interviewer was a man called Stavros. The Leader of the Opposition says, if it's true, Stavros, that men have more power, generally speaking, than women, is that a bad thing? And then a discussion ensues and another person being interviewed says, I want my daughter to have as much opportunity as my son. To which the Leader of the Opposition says, yeah, I completely agree, but what if men are by physiology or temperament more adapted to exercise authority or to issue command?
I first went to India in 1953, which was just 5 years after independence. And I was surprised. I used to carry around with me a 1 rupee paper note, because on that 1 rupee was written in, I think it was 22 different languages.
Oh, wow.
Value. And it was really a conglomeration of states. There were the princely states, where the British had honoured the authority, limited authority of the Rajas and the Maharajas. Mm-hmm. Then there were all the other states. And Nehru, who was the first Prime Minister, one of the first things he did was to realign a lot of the states according to language.
Oh.
So you had people in Bengal, for instance, who couldn't really converse with people in Kerala.
So he decided that was the most important thing, almost to get some sort of order, was let's do it on language, not on religion, because that's not working for us.
No, I think so. In a way, it was a bit like Australia. And in fact, the Indian Constitution borrowed something from Australia, because Sir Owen Phillips, I think his name was, our Chief Justice, had a part in contributing to that. But you see, my father fought in the Boer War, and did he fight as an Australian? Well, he was Australian, but there wasn't Australia. Australia didn't become a nation until 1901. We were colonies.
Right.
So he was a Victorian or a New South Welshman or a Queenslander.
Oh, wow, I see.
Australia was still a dream.
So he was a Victorian.
When I tried to track down his military history, I found he was with the British Light Horse, because a lot of Australians went, but they went as individuals, not as a national force.
Yeah, so, I mean, given that a lot of people are driven to fight wars and enjoy, you know, enjoy is not the right word, but are driven to that experience or to sign up, or if, you know, if they were enlisted, then it, you know, then a lot of people wanted to fight because they're wanting to fight for their country. What do you think for men like your father?
Australia's participation was in support of Britain.
Yeah.
But because we were colonies of Britain.
do you think that the passion would have been there to be a colony of Britain, or is no, we have to do this?
It's just the status quo.
Yeah.
And as we know, even in the Federation of Australia, Western Australia almost didn't join.
Oh, is that right?
Yes. So there were, and my wife's great grandfather, who was the acting premier of Queensland.
Oh wow! What an amazing suit. We got a black and white photo sitting up on your chest. Yes.
He was a representative of Queensland at the final Federation talks, and.
Amazing. What a fascinating time. See, we don't, you know, we my age group, and I'm sure younger.
That's why, my generation, some of this recent history, and you get a great deal on television, especially SBS.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Yes.
Because we were there. We lived there.
Do you think, I think Australians, we've always had a little bit of a, and not all, this is a real generalisation, but there can be a bit of a blasé attitude, and maybe I'm talking about my age group and, you know, younger, but a bit of a blasé-ness about our own history, and also about, you know, what we sort of stand for. From your age and looking at you know, back on so many decades of being an Australian, what do you think the most important thing is for us to know that we should, you know, that we need to actively seek out our history and know it? Like, what do you think why do we need to do that, do you think?
I think we have to acknowledge our history.
Mm.
And part of that, of course, is the role and the place in our nation of our Indigenous forefathers.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I grew up in an Australian where, you know, I remember the hostility towards Greek and Italian immigrants.
Yeah, I remember when I was growing up.
And then the Vietnamese boat people.
Yeah.
And the contribution they've made to Australia is incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, they have made Australia.
Mm.
And now the Aboriginal heritage is coming to the fore, and we're realising that storytelling and great art and I love the word dreaming. The dreaming.
Yeah, and I love the our Indigenous, the dream time,
absolutely,
spirituality.
Absolutely.
And I want to learn so much more about
and
that.
And their rhythms and their music and so on, and that has been so crudely ignored by
It still is.
And
I think we're missing out also from a selfish point of view about knowing
and they have, all of that. They have really made our nation, which truly is unique. I mean, whatever the bumps and boils and pimples, we are a wonderful nation moving into the future. And we get so bogged down in political party infighting that it's often ignored.
And, you know, I think you're right too. It just in terms of our going back and actually doing our research on who we are as a nation, which then breaks down to who we are as individuals, because I think we've given ourselves a get-out-of-jail-free card, a lot of us Australians, where we go, oh, yeah, but we, you know, oh, yeah, well, we're all new kind of Australian because we're all new Australians.
Yeah,
so, you know, we had English roots, we had these roots, or we had Vietnamese roots or whatever. It's almost like a little bit of a cop-out. I think we should know what that meant to us, but I think we should say if we've been here for, you know, a couple of generations, then we are Australians, and therefore we're making a contribution to Australia and to, you know, the future that we leave for children. But we have to go back and honestly go, well, what went on and how did we treat people?
That's right.
And rather than having this debate on whether we're sorry, just go, it happened. Yeah. It is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's the only way we can be honest and compassionate going forward.
My father's people came from Germany.
Yeah.
In 1854.
Wow.
And he, having fought in the Boer War, he then, his leg was shot a bit, so he was a bit, he had a bit of a limp. And when the First World War came along, he wasn't fit for service.
Mm.
So he changed his name, because his name originally, his father's name was Meyer,
mm-hmm.
and his mother's name was Schaefer. And Meyer, well, was a giveaway as a German, and not being in uniform, it was a bit embarrassing, so he changed it and tried to become an Englishman. Smoked a pipe and wore tweeds and pretended. He didn't really tell my mother the full story until much later.
The shame that people carry.
I know, and then we think of what all the generations of migration have contributed to the country and become proud Australians. It's a wonderful heritage we have.
I absolutely agree. Yeah. And I think it also goes back to what you said. It's, you know, change is a real thing.
Yeah.
It can happen on almost anything. I mean, you would look back, and unfortunately we have to wind up in a minute. But, you know, the reason I wanted to do this series is that, you know, your generation have seen more change than any other generation in history in terms of technology, communication.
That's true.
Everything. You've lived an extraordinary lifetime.
Yes, I have.
And so I would imagine it where you sit in at your life, out of any generation, you must know that anything can change.
Well, for 70 years, as I mentioned, I've been working with this international body called Initiatives of Change.
Okay, I'm going to look them up.
If you look them up, you'll find fascinating accounts. One of the people I interviewed, two of the people I interviewed in 1950 was the mayor of Nagasaki and the mayor of Hiroshima. The only two nations who've suffered the atomic bomb.
Wow.
And so bridge building and forgiveness and reconciliation has been very much part of what I've been working on all these years.
Wow. What a beautiful, beautiful contribution. Initiatives of Change.
And what it does is it's so broad, because it includes anyone who wants to take an initiative that will bring positive change in their situation, in any field.
Yes,
in education, in home life, in politics, in industry, whatever it is. But you'll find fascinating, the website.
Oh, yes. I bet. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, I'm very pleased.
What an interesting life you've led.
I have, actually, and I'm still going.
That's exactly right. Yeah, who knows what the next chapter... I might have to come back and interview you for another season. Thank you, Chris. Thank you so much. I'd like to thank Freedom Aged Care for introducing me to some of its wonderful residents for this series, who together have lived a million years of life. To find out more about Freedom Aged Care, head to freedomagedcare.com.au.